Scientific Review Group, Willapa Bay Planning Model Briefing with Andy Appleby.
We get a chance to get a refreshment here?
No, we're way behind schedule, so keep going.
Okay, I will, and I'm not going to help you, Chair Wecker. I have a sort of a passion for talking about this, and this particular talk usually runs a little over an hour. I went through it when I got invited to come here and was told I had 30 minutes and decided none of my slides were available for removal. I do tend to do a lot of off the top of my head sort of explanation as we go through these, so I promised myself to cut down on that and stick to the slides. So, but I do want to encourage you ask any questions along the way. It's very, very important that the commission understand the whole point of this. It's because of your hatchery fishery reform policy. It's actually at the heart of a lot of the changes that are taking place in hatcheries and in fisheries around the state. So, want you to very, very much understand this. So please stop me. And by the way, I should say, Andy Appleby. I'm currently the co-chair of the Hatchery Scientific Review Group. I'm a retired Department of Fish and Wildlife employee, and I'm pleased to say that I worked for the agency long enough that at one point Commissioner Schmitten was my boss. So that tells you how long. Okay. So for those of you that don't know, the Hatchery Scientific Review Group was formed in 1999. Congressman Norm Dix and Senator Slade Gordon at the time put together a bill that allowed for some funding. And then the real issue was, can we have hatcheries and still conserve natural populations? There had been a number of listings under ESA, as you'll recall, during the 90s. A lot of literature, and the scientific literature, that was suggesting that hatchery fish were part of the reason that the natural populations were in decline. And so those two folks put together a group of scientists. Commissioner Mankin was a founding member. And the whole point was, can we have hatcheries while supporting sustainable fisheries? And I put in parentheses here both commercial and recreational, and I want to make that very strong point to you, is that when we reviewed the Columbia River and looked at over 178 hatchery programs, over 300 natural populations affected by those hatchery programs, we, almost without exception, we could not solve the conservation objectives with the current size hatchery programs without some type of a commercial fishery along with a recreational fishery. And when I've given similar presentations to the public about Willapa, I always make it clear that these two fisheries should actually think of themselves as partners, because it takes both of their energies usually to remove the numbers of hatchery fish required. Now, I also make it clear that how those fisheries might need to look in the future may not be the traditional fisheries that have been thought of in those areas. Okay. So, principles of hatchery management: clear goals for both conservation and harvest, scientific defensibility in terms of the design of the plan, informed decision making. That forms the feedback loop. In the case of the Willapa Bay plan, my own opinion is that it does have clear goals for conservation and harvest. It is scientifically defensible. and seems to be a commitment to inform decision-making, that feedback loop. The important piece is not to have the plan and turn it on and then walk away from it. The important piece is to have the plan, to start it running, and then to check and use that check to go back and see is the system working like we thought it was going to work. And so there needs to be times and places for that feedback mechanism in order for it to work. Cornerstones here: broodstock management, integrated segregated populations. I'll talk to that in just a second. Population designations and compliance with environmental regulations. And I only mentioned that once here. Obviously, the HSRG believes, as most folks do, that hatcheries should be in compliance with existing environmental regulations. The example I tell folks is that when your house was built, it was probably in compliance with the current codes, and that's the same with most of our hatchery facilities. But if you do some remodeling, they don't make you tear your whole house down and rebuild it to code, but that new stuff that you add needs to be to the existing standards. In that case, many of your hatcheries, in terms of their intake screens, their water withdrawal systems, were in compliance at the time they were constructed. But there is a lot of new regulation out there in terms of screen diameter, impingement velocities, all kinds of technical stuff. And as they get rebuilt, obviously we're encouraging folks to bring those into compliance. And in fact, that's our impression that is happening. So a little HSRG 101, broodstock management, integrated, segregated. First thing is, I got to teach you a couple of terms, because this is the big idea here is gene flow between the wild and the hatchery and the wild. And so to understand that, we have a brief list of terms here that I want to run through quickly. PNOB, percent of natural origin fish in the hatchery broodstock. Those are natural, and I prefer to call them natural origin. We do, instead of wild. Let's just say that they were spawned in the wild. Those fish coming in and being used in the hatchery broodstock is the gene flow from the hatchery to the wild. PHOS is those hatchery fish that don't end up in the hatchery pond and end up spawning in the wild. That's the gene flow from the hatchery to the wild. It isn't can be confusing. It isn't the stray rate. When you hear a PHOS of 30%, that isn't the stray rate. Okay? But PHOS is affected by the stray rate, because you can have a very low stray rate for a hatchery population, meaning only 5% of the hatchery fish don't end up coming back to the hatchery, right? But if it's a large hatchery program and you have a very small natural population, then 5% of that great big number can overwhelm the natural population. Finally, P&I is just the metric that we use, proportion of natural influence. That basically tells you what side of the scale is more heavily weighted. Higher the P&I means there's more influence by the natural environment, and that's really what we're talking about. I did want to focus a little more on PHOS, because there's been, part of it is our fault, but there's been some more and more confusion about PHOS, not only from lay people, but even technical staff that we have talked to over the last couple months. So there's a couple of kinds of PHOS. Each one is a refinement on the previous. And remember what PHOS is. PHOS is about how much gene flow that goes from the hatchery to the wild. So the first example of PHOS is simply a count. Your stream surveys go out and they count Chinook carcasses, and they get, hey, this proportion were clipped. Okay? That's a census PHOS. And as it turns out, if that's your only estimate of gene flow, then we recommend that's what you use, because at least that gives you an estimate. However, we recognize that hatchery fish are not 100% successful at spawning in the wild. So just because you may have counted 100 hatchery fish in your stream surveys, not all of those will be successful at reproducing. So what the HSRG has used and what AHA calculates is effective PHAS. That's always a smaller number than was actually counted. So that's it's important to note that, because we've had conversations with technical staff amongst the co-managers who were thinking, well, I went out and counted X number of Chinook that had clips, and that's my PHAS, and that's above your standard. So we encourage them to say, to think of it differently. Effective PHAS is really what you're trying to get to. That's a better estimate. That's what AHA calculates for you, and that is also what the standard, HSRG standards, and your hatchery fishery reform policy are based on, effective PHAS. That's different than census PHAS. And finally, I'd like to give credit to your own Dr. Ken Warheit, who's a recent addition to the HSRG. Through his steelhead work, he's developed this proportion of effective hatchery contribution. Through genetic techniques, he can actually measure the gene flow. You don't have to estimate it. And that we believe that's a great addition to the whole concept, because especially with some of the tribal bios who argue about census and effective PHAS, which census is a count that you know is too high. Effective is an estimate that we can argue what theories behind that, but this PEHC is actually a measurement, and bottom line is that's what we want to understand is how much and the direction of actual gene flow. So great addition there to the concepts. I'll quickly go through these. I hope you have a really reasonable understanding. Segregated brood stocks, object of the hatchery is to create two separate populations. Think of Chambers Creek, early winter steelhead. There's no intention for those fish to spawn naturally. There's no intention for there to be any gene flow between the hatchery and the natural population. Over time, those populations will diverge. The essence of maintaining a single population is that you have gene flow between those two populations. Without gene flow, they will diverge. They're perfectly fine. The HSRG has no preference for segregated or integrated programs. We do have different standards for the gene flow for those two, but in terms of the basic programs, it makes no difference to us. On the other side, the integrated broodstock is a little more complex. You are trying to maintain one population specifically, and more specifically than that, you're trying to maintain a population that has more impact from the natural environment than it does from the hatchery environment in terms of its adaptation. Key differences here. Let's go through the segregated real quickly because it's fairly straightforward. So you've got a separate hatchery population which might very well be suited for your intended goal, whether that's a harvest goal. You rarely see segregated populations for conservation, although I would argue Redfish Lake Sockeye and for a while a White River Spring Chinook that were kept in captive brood, that's a segregated population for conservation. You're just trying to preserve the genome, right? So it can happen, but not very often. Most segregated programs are for harvest. So the point of those is that those hatchery fish are going to end up different than the natural fish. So that means you want to keep them separate. They may be most appropriate where you have a low probability of hatchery fish spawning with natural fish, producing fish where spawning habitat no longer exists. Cowlett Spring Chinook is a great example of a segregated broodstock, and actually does have a conservation role. There are three dams on the Cowlitz. All the Spring Chinook habitat, everyone acknowledges, was above those dams, but there's still a Cowlett Spring Chinook, and they are still unique and identifiable as such. That's a good thing to have those around, and so they run a segregated program there, primarily for harvest, but also for preserving the genome. Obviously, you want to release your smolts and have adult collection facilities that are separated from natural spawning areas. Okay, here's the big idea that I need to spend a little bit of time on. And this is the theory behind the integrated program. It's actually not something that the HSRG came up with. Mike Ford, who's a geneticist for National Marine Fisheries Service, wrote a paper in 2002 building on the work of others that talks about how gene flow may affect domestication. Imagine, if you will, remember what I said, we're trying to maintain a single population with integrated programs. And if you will imagine any phenotypic trait that you want to measure, a phenotypic trait is some trait that you can measure, age at maturity, fecundity, size at maturity, anything you can put a set of calipers on and get measurements for, there might very well be one optimum in the hatchery environment and one optimum in the natural environment. And it's not a question of good or bad, but it's a question of every time that fish reproduces, just like evolution works in nature, its environment is pulling on it, trying to make it better and better for the environment that it's in. As I used to lecture to hatchery managers, I said, you're not making bad wild fish. You're making better and better hatchery fish, because the fish naturally adapt to whatever environment they're in. And the more generations they've been in a hatchery, then the better and better hatchery fish they become. The problem with that is those traits that may be ideally suited for the hatchery end up not serving the fish very well when it spawns in the wild. So then the question becomes, we need to balance that, which is why, remember what PNOB is, remember what PHAS is. That's the gene flow from natural to hatchery and hatchery to wild, and it's all about the balancing act so that for the single population as a whole, the natural environment is having more influence on shaping those fish than the hatchery environment. That ends up being the PNI. Quick schematic of that, and it's important to note, we have the wild population at the top, the hatchery population at the bottom, and we have some gene flow. Those arrows represent the gene flow, PNOB and PHAS. And it's important to note here, the size of that PNOB arrow is actually appropriate. In order for the natural environment to have more influence, then you have to have more gene flow coming from the natural environment to the hatchery environment than you have going from the hatchery to the natural environment. That's why basic premise of an integrated program, PNOB has to be greater than PHAS. More gene flow coming from the wild than is going into the wild from the hatchery perspective. That's really the secret there. Integrated programs, obviously the goal is that natural selection in the wild drives the fitness of the population as a whole, so that when those fish do spawn naturally, they are more similar to natural origin fish. And actually, if you're concerned about climate change and salmon habitat, our belief is that the best thing you can do for the fish is to play to its strength. The strength of salmon is to rapidly adapt to new environments. They've proven this over and over again. As I used to tell folks, 10,000 years ago, there were no salmon in Puget Sound. We know that because the geologists say there was a quarter of a mile of ice here in Olympia. There was a mile of ice in Seattle. There was no Puget Sound for salmon to be in. So as the ice retreated, stray hatchery, I wish they were hatchery fish, but they weren't. Salmon strayed into Puget Sound. And salmon have a very, very odd life cycle when you think about it. One generation, they spawn and they die. That's not uncommon in insects, not uncommon in plants, but kind of odd for vertebrates. They actually put a lot of energy into that one time, right? That also tells you that they must be able to quickly adapt, because that next generation, it's all up to them. Mom and dad aren't coming back to try it again in a couple years and learn, right? So they really have the gift of rapidly adapting to new environments. That's how they've been successful. And that's what we want them to be. So if you have populations that are well adapted to their current environment, that means they will also be in a position to begin adapting should that environment change, for the better or the worse. So that's our point about if you're concerned about climate change, having the fish able to adapt and ready to adapt is a very positive thing. Obviously, the big thing about integrated programs that sometimes can stymie folks' attempts is, guess what? They have to have a self-sustaining natural population, right? Because you're drawing brood every year from this natural population. You have to have one. So that often requires different ways of thinking about harvest management. And in fact, we would suggest that in your escapement goals for natural origin fish to a river system, if you have a hatchery program on that river that requires a certain number of natural origin brood stock, you might consider adding that number of natural origin fish to your escapement goal. Makes perfect sense. Maybe most appropriate for hatchery programs with conservation goals or when the risk of natural spawning to HORs needs to be minimized. Well, what that means is that we are recognizing the challenges of keeping populations separate, as in attempting to run just a segregated program. Being able to hold weirs in, especially with coho populations, is just not realistic. And we're learning, while in theory and in a lot of cases it has worked fairly well with Chinook, that's not even always the case, depending on the river system. So you want to minimize the difference between the populations. Integrated programs is what you typically end up doing. Speaking of populations, let's talk about the designations. Again, HSRG did not craft these. We borrowed these from the Lower Columbia River Recovery Board and their plan. They basically have three levels of population importance, and that was based on what they believe the historic significance of each one of those populations was. And it's a bit of a triage. And the reason it's important is because I think we can all agree that historically, when you take an area like Willapa Bay or Grays Harbor or Puget Sound or the Columbia River, not every one of those streams that had, for instance, Chinook, produced the same size of population. Habitats are different. Capacities are different. Nacelle may have produced a lot more Chinook than the Palax forever, right? And so in terms of conservation biology and having VSP or viable salmon populations characteristics sort of captured for an area, the Lower Columbia River Recovery Plan has that and says we're going to identify important, really important populations. We're going to call them primary. We're going to have a low tolerance for hatchery impacts. And we want to really make sure that those primaries are in good shape. We're going to have a category called contributing, which are still important, but probably just were never as large as those primary populations. They help give the ESU or the biogeographic region diversity. And then we're going to have stabilizing populations, which in their view, may have even been ephemeral, may have blinked on and off. High abundance years, some stream may have had a population in it. Low abundance years, you may not have seen much. It's still a value to the ESU or the biogeographical region, but it's certainly not worthy of consideration in terms of primary when you're talking about impacts of hatcheries or impacts of anything else. So, kind of covered most of this. Why are they important? Different levels of risk tolerance is the big thing. And it also allows you to evaluate two populations in different areas. Are they both primaries? It wouldn't be fair to hold a primary population or to the same standards as you do a stabilizing population because you have different risk tolerances there. And it all adds to balancing the region that you're trying to manage. Because we have different risk tolerances, that implies different standards. And here is where the sort of the rubber meets the road, right? Primaries, we have low tolerance for hatchery influence. That means a high P&I standard. and a low PHA standard for segregated programs. Contributing, we've reduced our standard for P&I. Notice it still has to be above 0.5, because above 0.5 tells you that the natural environment is at least having a little more influence on the population than the hatchery in environment. You can have a hatchery program with P&Is less than 0.5. Believe me, most of the hatcheries in Washington State have P&Is less than 0.5. All right? Huge effort aimed at the last two or three years in changing that. But as I like to remind folks, what that tells us is that for the last 100, 110 years, we've actually been operating our hatcheries to make the wild fish more like hatchery fish. Now, we didn't do it on purpose. Actually, we hadn't. Some of these theories and ideas hadn't been thought through yet. But that's really why I have so much faith in, I think, the concept and the model that I'll talk about in a second is we're seeing the exact outcome that you would have predicted, knowing what I know now about integrated, segregated, and P&Is, based on how we've run our hatchery programs for the last 120 years. How's the gene flow been? It's been almost all from the wild to the hatchery, which we believe reduces the productivity of the natural population. It makes the populations we have all look the same, right? Green River Wild and Green River Hatchery, they look the same. Skokomish Wild and Skokomish Hatchery, they look the same. Well, that's what you'd expect because of the gene flow mixing. And which direction has that been? They all look like the hatchery version. All right? They don't look like the wild version. So the other important point to remind folks is that this isn't a crazy new idea that has just come out. It's actually looking at how the system has been run since we started running it, and now being conscious of, oh, that amount and direction of gene flow is actually pretty critical into how these fish end up looking, and more importantly, how they end up functioning in the natural environment. Okay, let's talk about AHA. What is AHA really? What have I been talking about this whole time? Gene flow. AHA is a gene flow calculator. It uses the four H's as inputs, and that's habitat, hydro, harvest, and hatcheries. If you were around in the salmon world in the 90s with all the listings, everybody said there's four H's. There's four reasons why we have listed salmon, right? So AHA uses inputs from all four of those. Now, hydro may or may not be as important in a particular area. It's obviously very important in the Columbia River, not so much in Great Harbor or Willapaw Bay, but AHA's got a place there for if you need to use it. Its currency is adult spawning fish, hatchery and wild. Simple as that. It's trying to get at gene flow, so it's got to come up with numbers of fish and where those each spawn. So it calculates the number of natural and hatchery fish produced and where they end up spawning. Those are those arrows that I was showing you earlier, the gene flow, the PNOB and the PHOS. That's what it does. And what it results is an estimation of fitness loss due to domestication. Domestication is what this is all about. Domestication is fish looking like really good hatchery fish, all right? And if you're – quick little story that I like to tell, if you're not convinced that domestication is real, I can tell you from personal experience, and I know the agency has a lot of experience, you go out and get natural origin eggs or fry or even adults and spawn them and put those in the hatchery – they are lousy hatchery fish. They are spooky. They don't eat. They get sick at the drop of a hat. That's a very, very powerful sign to me that these fish are different. They have evolved. Now, if you run that program for several generations, guess what? Suddenly those fish become more domesticated. Suddenly they're not as spooky in the pond. Suddenly they can tolerate a little more crowding. Suddenly they grow better because they're eating better. All those things have made a huge impression on me, and I know many, many folks that have recognized that it's not about good and bad. It's about the fish doing exactly what you would predict. and that is trying as hard as it can to adapt to the environment that it's in. And those traits that help it are preserved, and those traits that don't help it end up going away. So, important thing here, thoughts on using AHA. It does not absolutely define effects of actions, and I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I can predict with 100% certainty that the AHA model results are going to be what you're going to see tomorrow or in 5 years or 10 years or an average over 100 generations, which is how long AHA actually calculates things. It does, however, provide a hypothesis for interaction of the H's. That's a fancy way of saying it tells you, it allows you to say, this is how I think the system works, all right? This is how the habitat produces natural fish. This is how the hatchery produces hatchery fish and how they interact. M&E is required for sure to test assumptions and adjust your actions. That's, remember the third part of that feedback loop, goals, scientific defensibility, and M&E. That's how that works. It does, and an important point, just flat out, does not analyze ecological impacts of hatcheries, predation, competition. What impact do coho smolts have on pink and chum fry? Doesn't talk about that. What impact from a competition standpoint do hatchery coho smolts and wild coho smolts? What positives and negatives are going on there? Not in AHA. Okay. There are other models around, actually, that do try to quantify that, but it's not in AHA. So here's how AHA looks now. And there's kind of a running joke I have with Lars Mobrand, who's also an HSRG member and quite a gifted programmer, is that if I hadn't heard from Lars in about a week, I'm guessing there's a new version of AHA. Okay? This currently we're working on version 15 right now, and it's very powerful. This is an example from Nacelle, speaking of the Willapaw. And again, I can point out that here are the H's, habitat potential. This is the hydro piece. This is the harvest rate, and this is the hatchery program. So there's inputs for all of those. Habitat potential, we use simple Beverden-Holt functions of productivity and capacity of the watershed. Remember, AHA's got to calculate a number of natural origin fish. And in order to do that, it needs to know how good the habitat is. In the case of Willapaw, we use a 1 indicating that there is no hydro loss as smolts are going out or adults are coming in. So now I know now I add in the harvest rates differentially, if there are some, between unmarked and marked fish. I know the hatchery program, how many smolts are released, how well they survive, and how good the hatchery is at trapping the returning adults. Once I have those basic ideas, I can generate natural fish and subtract out how many are harvested. I can generate hatchery fish and subtract out how many are harvested and how many of those hatchery fish return appropriately to the hatchery. That leaves me with an estimate of how many are on the spawning grounds. Guess what that is? That's my PHOF, my PNOB, and my PNI. The one thing that I always like to make sure folks understand is that when we begin using AHA, this baseline step is what we sort of refer to as a calibration step. This is hindcasting. We know what the escapement to hatcheries have been on average the last 10 years. We know what their hatchery program has been on average the last 10 years. We know what the spawning ground escapement counts have been, right? So we can average, we have those values. We put what we think are the appropriate values in AHA, and we see if in this output chart at the bottom, is that matching what the biologists tell us actually went on? That takes a bit, but we almost always can get this predicting reasonably well. Now, that's hindcasting. Once we have that step complete, now we're ready to forecast, to look forward. And then that's where we start adding the various plans and options. Here's an example of that. Again, using Nacelle Chinook, The habitat hasn't changed. We've changed some of the harvest rates. We've changed the program, and we've gone from, assuming in this option they sell as a primary, we've gone from a program that was not meeting the standards in your hatchery and fishery reform policy to one that meets them very well. And recognizing that the hatchery program has had to change in order to do that. And that's part of the function of, in our view, hatchery management. It also, frankly, depending on what your population designation is, because recall, there's different standards for different population designations. Depending on how you designate a population, that may let you increase the hatchery program over what it is currently. Okay, and the last piece of the new AHA is a life cycle model, which was developed for a very specific reason. AHA looks out over 100 Chinook generations. Well, that's 400 years, right? It actually runs for about 20 generations until it reaches, we call it equilibrium, until that P&I sort of settles down and is in a pretty good spot, and then it does the average of that over 80 generations. Well, that's 320 years, okay? Now, much as I'm interested in Willapaw, I'm not going to be around 200 or 300 years from now to be able to say, oh, yeah, look at the AHA results predicted. They're coming out to be right, or no, they're not right. So the life cycle model was added, and I think most recently for work that was done on the cowlitz, but it's also been used in a couple other places. The point of it is that we understood that you have very aggressive goals for achieving natural origin escapement. In the Willapaw, for example, I think it's 10 years. So AHA really wasn't of much use for that, right? We could say we know for sure you'll be there in 300, all right? That's probably not very helpful to folks that have to make management decisions. So the life cycle model was added to allow you to look at those shorter-term objectives. Now, to be sure, because I don't think there's a person in this room that can believe they can accurately predict what the fall Chinook run of natural origin fish to Willapaw or Nacelle is going to be 2 years from now, and I'm not one, believe me, I'm not about to say that I can do that. But what the life cycle model can do is to give you an example of what might happen, and because it is the life cycle model varies survival around the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, okay? And we now have a nice data set of about 60, 70 years of that oscillation. So that's why you'll see a single graph here, which is the middle value. The light green line is your escapement goal. The x-axis is actual years, and you'll see here's the AHA prediction over 300 years, this dashed line here, okay? Well, what that main green line that shows you that you'll come pretty close to your escapement goals in the near term, but that's created over here. And what we did to try to show folks the kind of variability they could expect is to say, for instance, this light green line, this is the PDO beginning in 1955 and running for 10 years, all right? And this is the PDO in 1980. So, and this happens to be the PDO starting in 2013, and then because we don't have 2014 or 15 data, it goes back to 1954 where our database starts and starts running again. The whole point of this was to give you a range to say, here's the known data set. Here's the known cycle. It could be this bad. It could be this good. It could be somewhere in the middle. I didn't have this slide in until just recently. I wanted to add it only because there's been, in my conversations with folks over the last month or so, there's begun to be some confusion. It's not intended to be a value statement at all. Please don't take it that way. I just want to make it very clear that what HSRG has been asked to do is develop a tool to allow WDF&W to analyze options, both your policy and your operational options. The HSRG has not been asked to review the plan, and I'm not suggesting that we need to be. I just want to make it clear to folks, we haven't reviewed the plan. We've not been asked to review the options. I think the model that we have developed will do an excellent job of sorting that out. The options that you have to work with either will or won't achieve your stated objectives, and that's really the answer that you're looking for, and I know the ad hoc group is looking for as well. It's about crafting an option that meets your objectives. That's as simple as that. For those of you that are interested, list of our reports here, original report in April of 04, Columbia River in 09, review of the LWA program in 2012. We've just put out a white paper on the science of hatcheries, June of 2014, and they're all available at this website. So I don't know how I did for time, Chair, but...
You did pretty well.
Okay.
Nice job. Thanks.
Questions?
Okay. Commissioner Holtzmiller.
This one's way more of a comment than a question. Having been involved in salmon and steelhead projects for 20-some years and also raising cattle in a harsh environment, and we're always trying to make our cattle fit our environment, I am just sad that we could not have this deal on tape to play for all the restoration committees in my side of the state, because this just cut a whole bunch of questions out of my mind how the system works. Now, we got to get you on tape, because it does. It just, we always hear about hatchery scientific groups. This just cleared up a whole lot of things in my world.
Good.
Thank you.
In a good way, I hope.
Yes. Okay. No, I mean, good. It was very positive. I wish everybody could see this, because it did. It cleared up a whole lot of questions in my mind how the system works. Thank you.
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one question. Andy, why is your phone number not on here? There will be calls.
Right. Okay. I'm happy to answer calls. As Commissioner Mankin knows, and others, over the years, I've given this talk or similar talks probably 50 or 60 times. I love doing it. I hope it shows that I have a passion for it and have a sense for it. And as I say, keeping me to a half hour, I think I probably took 40 minutes. That's you did good.
You did good. Director Anderson.
Thanks, Andy. I remember my first presentation that you gave me in my office on this.
How many years ago?
That's not important, necessarily.
Well, Sarah Laborde was in the room. Yeah. I remember that. It was 10 years ago or so. So about four slides back from the last one, the one that had the two projection.
I have to do it with my glasses.
Do you need some help, Andy? I could help you with that.
Yeah.
There you go.
This one?
Yeah.
There you go.
So I'm having, first of all, I was having a little trouble distinguishing the differences in the green tones.
Yeah, I apologize for that, right.
But, so I guess I'm more interested in, my question has to do with the one on the right.
This one?
You know, and I applaud the HSRG, Lars, for looking at a way to look at a shorter time frame than 300 or 400 or whatever it is, because I'm in the same boat you are about not being here then. But I know when we're looking at trying to meet our hatchery objectives, I suspect that when you look at a 10-year time frame versus, say, a 20-year time frame, there are going to and based on what your projections are as to what the PDO is going to be, how it's going to behave. The severity in terms of the changes you need to make, if you're able to look at achieving your goal over a slightly longer period of time than a shorter period of time, there's probably gives you some more management flexibility. Is that a
The flexibility that it gives me, I would argue, is that, and this is my own personal opinion, but looking to achieve the spawner escapement goals in 10 years, wow, that's two Chinook generations, okay? Now, what we felt like it was very important is to be able, and that's your goal, that's fine. That's in our view, that's very aggressive. Why? Because part of the increase, a great deal of the increase, is you're relying on this improvement in fitness. You're relying on these fish to become better adapted to the Nacelle River. Well, adaptation only happens once a generation, right? When the reproduction takes place. That's how you pass those improvements on to the next generation. And if you only have one of those, essentially, because 10 years is the full cycle for the first group that was spawned naturally, it's not difficult to meet the hatchery broodstock standards. Let me be clear about that. You can, and as a matter of fact, except for being a little bit short on PNOB, the programs have already been changed in Willapaw Bay, right? There's a question of they might need to go find a few more natural origin fish to incorporate into broodstock, but the programs are already changed. It's easy to meet the broodstock standards. You'll have to wait, of course, the life cycle for the PHAS to drop, especially if you've lowered the program. You still got fish out there in the ocean that are swimming around waiting to their turn to come back. So you gotta wade through that, but that's one life cycle. So 4 or 5 years, you should be achieving the standards from a broodstock perspective. We felt it was important to be able to demonstrate that whether or not you've achieved some level in 10 years, there's definitely forward progress. And I think that's as important as anything, is that whether it happens in one generation or maybe it takes two or three generations to recover enough fitness with some changes in harvest to get you to your escapement goal, at least you want to be able to show a positive move in the right direction. I don't know, Director, if that answers your question. Or
yes, okay. It does. I had one other, if I might. So I need some help in understanding the graphic on the PDO side of this. If I take the 1980 one, which I think is the bottom, that's the bright shade of green.
Yes.
Yeah. So when you're starting back on year one, does that on 1980, is year one 1980?
Yes.
And then you're bringing that forward over time as to how the PDO changed over a 10-year frame from 1980 to 1990, correct?
Yep.
So you're having, obviously, to make some assumptions when you do that, and you started at 2013.
Correct. Well, we have a loop. At 2013, our database starts in 1954.
Okay.
So if you start in 2013, that's the last data set. It goes back to 1954 and does 9 more years of whatever the PDO did in 1954.
Okay.
Okay. Same. Yeah. Good question. What we have talked to Jim about and others is, take the worst 10 years of the PDO and start. That'll be your bottom line. Take the best 10 consecutive years of the PDO. That'll be your top line. And then here's some kind of average values in between there.
Yeah, my memory of the 80s is that we went through some good times and bad times from
rocky.
A PD. It was really rocky. We got up to, I think, 1983 was kind of the bottom. 1988 was pretty good, and then we went into the early 90s, and then we dove into the tank again.
Right.
And so
the 80s were very, very mixed PDO-wise. And I wish I didn't take a picture. Actually, the model, you can go to one tab, and it shows you here, so that you can scroll around and say, oh, I want to start here because that looks like a very poor sequence of time. So it lets the user define that, and it's just a chart that shows the PDO, and you can scroll the mouse around and click on whatever year you want.
And is it So we're trying to use the PDO to estimate what the ocean productivity conditions are, right?
Yes,
so,
sir.
Okay, all right, thanks.
The range in productivity. Commissioner Mencken.
Good job, Andy.
Oh, thank you.
I'm proud of you. I have a question about the efficacy and the efficiency of HSRG HSRG efficacy, say in a given watershed, where you have hatcheries that are operated by different entities. For example, there are examples where you have tribal and state hatcheries, tribal, state, and federal hatcheries operating in the same watershed. To what extent have those entities bought into the HSRG principles in any given watershed? Do you have good examples?
It varies. Recognize that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had a review very similar to ours and actually had some – Don Campton led that effort. And they are sort of marching in the same direction as Department of Fish and Wildlife in terms of a policy statement that said we're going to move forward and do this. So what we have seen is big efforts on the Columbia River, especially the lower Columbia. Then the upper Columbia, I'm thinking of the spring Chinook hatchery programs up there. Because of their ESA endangered status, they always had very, very conservative kind of guidelines anyway, and so they're close. Lots of changes in the lower Columbia, both federal and state-run facilities, and a lot of interest in Puget Sound. We have some tribal hatcheries that have led the way in terms of adapting. I'm thinking of the Tulalips on the Sky. They were very much into this early on. The programs that we run out of the Wallace River Hatchery, you run out of the Wallace River Hatchery have been in compliance and we're one of the first. So leaders in that area. Nisqually is making a concerted effort to adopt very similar standards and run their fall Chinook and coho programs in accordance. So there's a wherever you want to look, there's an example of the positive and maybe the not so positive. Is that doesn't help you much.
That's close. That's close. I think what I'm driving at is in the Willapa we have the advantage of not having complicated systems run by separate entities. We have the WDF&W hatcheries in the Willapa. We have the opportunity to really shine when it comes to scientifically based hatchery reform in the Willapa.
That's the fact not lost on the HSRG, as you well know.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments, questions? Director Anderson.
Well, I just wanted to echo what Commissioner Mencken said. Thank you very much, Andy. Okay. Great job. And I don't know that I can say this about a lot of people, but I could listen to Andy give this presentation another four or five times, and I still wouldn't get bored because I keep learning every time I hear it.
And I would
every
encourage
time
you, because we like to joke in the HSRG, it often, and even for technical people, it often takes two or three hearings and thinking about this until they get the aha moment.
But that's separate from the model.
Right.
Yesterday when we were talking about our HGMPs and our process and looking at having both the state tribal but also having this third party help us with ensuring that the HGMPs, as they're developed, that are submitted to NOAA, you know, have a solid muster in terms of meeting the requirements, why having this type of third-party review is so important and really makes what your submissions are a lot stronger, and the review process also, as a result, is a lot stronger. So that's the other piece.
Yeah, one other comment. It also standardizes the scientific approach towards comparison between basins and in the HGMPs. In my estimation, it stands up in court.
Thank you so much, Andy. Just terrific job.